Welcome to another Buzz Marketing for Technology podcast, conducted in cooperation with Marketing Props. I'm your host, Paul Dunay, and today I'm speaking with Duncan Watts of Yahoo, who has challenged the hypothesis of the influentials and whose research was recently cited in a Fast Company article entitled, Is the Tipping Point Toast? So welcome to the podcast, Duncan.
Thanks very much, Paul.
Excellent. So can you give us a quick recap of the research that you did that challenged the hypothesis of the influentials?
Okay, so there are a couple of different strands of research that I've been pursuing over the last few years. The one that sort of most directly addresses this idea that, you know, in word of mouth marketing, in social change in general, the changes that we observe are driven by a handful of special individuals and how they and their ability to influence everybody else. The work that has directly considered that claim is really a series of mathematical and simulation models that I conducted with my colleague Peter Dodds over the last few years, where we actually, you know, build, you know, a large variety of what you might think of as artificial worlds, where everybody in that world has some default state, and we're trying to get them to adopt some new product or idea. And everybody has some intrinsic preference or attitude about that, some way that they would respond independently, but they also care about what other people think. And so everybody is influenced by some number of other people in this complex network of influence. And so what we're able to do in these simulations is pick out the individuals in this network who are most influential, who influence the most number of their peers. And we can single them out and say, you know, in a very quantitative way, these people are influential. These are the people who you would like to target in some sort of word of mouth campaign, maybe by, you know, giving them some free samples or otherwise soliciting their help. And we can essentially launch any number of these hypothetical campaigns, starting out with influentials, and we can compare the outcome of those attempts very quantitatively and precisely with the outcome of other attempts where we don't attempt to target influentials, where we just start with average people. And there are two main results that come out of these simulations. The first one is that, you know, how successful you are in your campaign depends far more on the sort of overall structure of the network, on properties that are not associated with any one individual at all, influential or not, but rather on how large numbers of individuals are connected to each other, and very little on who actually starts the cascade or tries to initiate the fad. So, you know, the sort of basic first result is that, you know, either the network is sort of conducive to the spread of influence, in which case it doesn't really matter where you start, almost anyone will do, or else the network isn't conducive to the spread of influence, in which case there's really nothing that anyone can do. So the analogy that we make is sort of like a forest fire, that, you know, forest fires come in all sizes, from very small to very large, and we sort of understand intuitively that, or from at least from experience, that the difference between small and large has everything to do with generic conditions like, you know, low humidity and prolonged high temperatures and strong winds and you know, rugged terrain, and very little to do with the sort of properties of the spark that start the fire. And, you know, what we want to say is that the same or similar intuition applies to the spread of influence in human networks as well. So that's the first result. The second result is that, all other things being equal, it does turn out that highly influential people, measured in this sort of local sense of how many others they influence directly, do, on average, tend to do better than average individuals. So this is sort of, you know, somewhat supportive of the very general nature of the claim that influentials matter. But what's surprising is that under a very broad range of conditions, their additional impact is rather weak, right? So the excitement associated with the influentials hypothesis is that if you pick the right people to start with, you get a huge bang for your buck. You get this sort of massive multiplier effect. And so if a influential person influences five times as many people directly as an average person, you expect to get at least 5 times as many people in total as a result of this, of starting the campaign with that person, and possibly many times more. In fact, one of the popular claims is that the impact or the multiplier effect of influentials is disproportionately great compared to their local influence. And what we find is actually the opposite, that when you run these simulations, and again, we make large numbers of assumptions, and we try all kinds of different networks and dynamics, we find consistently that the impact of influentials is disproportionately less than you would expect, and often, not measurably greater than an average person at all. And the reason for that is that, influence is something that we measure locally. How many people do you influence directly? But what you care about is the total number of people influenced over time, and that is an indirect measure, right? Because you influence your friends, and they influence their friends, and those people influence their friends. And so we have this sort of multi-step process spreading throughout the network, and only if that happens do you get large numbers of people adopting your product via a word-of-mouth campaign. And so what we show is that the total number of people who are influenced in that kind of multi-step cascade is, again, much more dependent on the dynamics of the network, well beyond the local influence of the influential themselves. So even if somebody influences 5 times as many people directly as somebody else, the total number of influence depends on these sort of multi-step cascade, and these differences in the local sphere tend to even out in the global sphere. So this is sort of a somewhat counterintuitive point, because we don't have very good intuition for non-local processes. We can't really think about, what happens beyond our friends. We think it's very easy for us to think about, which of our friends we influence, which of our friends influence us. It's very hard for us to think about the indirect influence that we're experiencing from somebody, 2 or 3 or 5 steps away from us that is mitigated or transmitted via our friends. And so, that's why we have to that's why we can learn at least. I'm not going to say we should rely on simulations, but we can certainly learn from these kinds of simulations to kind of educate us about how our intuitions about the social world can lead us astray. So, that's the main body of evidence that we present against this argument. And you might say, well, that's interesting, but, these are just computer simulations. And in fact, this is a very common response. You're not dealing with real people here. You're making all kinds of assumptions. This is not real. So to try to address that part of the question, we conducted a set of experiments with human subjects that are somewhat different from the simulations, but ultimately get to a similar point, where we created an artificial market for music, new songs that people hadn't heard of, and we got about 27,000 people to come along and participate and agree to listen to these songs and rate them and download them. And what we showed in this experiment is that when people can see what they think other people like, it obviously affects their behavior. So songs that are already rated as popular are more likely to be listened to and downloaded than songs that are not already rated as popular. And that may seem reasonable and even obvious at an individual level. What's less obvious is how all those little nudges, all those little effects of social influence aggregate to the level of the whole market. And what we're able to show there is that in a world where social influence matters, again, this is compared to a world in which people behave independently and have to express their preferences without knowing what other people think. In a world of social influence, the popular songs get much more popular and the unpopular songs become less popular. But at the same time, it becomes much, much harder to predict which of the songs is going to be the most popular. So you see that social influence generates much bigger variance and also much greater unpredictability than in a world where people are behaving independently. And critically, this, you know, which song turns out to be popular depends a lot on the activities and the decisions of people who sort of come into the process early on. And you might think, aha, that means that they're influentials, right? Those people, you know, again, if you look at the outcome of this experiment and you see that this one particular song has become popular and you go back in time and you find that there were a few people who voted for it early on, you might conclude that those people were influential. But we actually know, by the way we constructed this experiment, that there's nothing special about these people at all, right? They're just the same as everybody else. It's just because of this sort of random allocation process that they happen to show up early on in the picture, and therefore they have a disproportionate weight on the vote of the whole population. And so what this tells us is that what we learn about the world after the fact, right, when we see something interesting happen, that we're very tempted to go back to the early stages of that event and look for some kind of cause and say, look, this is a special event. It must have been generated by a special cause. And we find invariably that somebody was doing something, you know, whether it's the sort of hipsters wearing hush puppies in the East Village or whatever it is, somebody is doing something near the beginning of that trend. And we're very tempted to assign the sort of weight of causality to those people. But what we're able to show with these experiments is that actually, you know, those people are just ordinary people doing ordinary things. And in some other version of the world, someone else equally ordinary was doing something different, and that led to a very different outcome. So the combination of these two kinds of studies, one based on simulations and the other one based on experiments, gives us a certain level of confidence that this view of the world that, you know, everything important is driven by a few important individuals is not just sort of an oversimplification, but actually quite a misleading one in terms of the way things actually happen.
Now, I find myself thinking a little bit about the theories of 6 degrees of separation as you're talking, and I also noted that you wrote a book called 6 degrees. Was that part of this research? How did that inform your research in this case?
Well, it's absolutely part of it. I mean, for over 10 years now, I've been heavily invested in studying the structure of social networks, in building mathematical models to understand that structure, trying to understand how networks change over time, and also, and what's most relevant here, trying to understand how network interactions affect behavior. You know, this is sort of really the core of what sociology is about, is trying to understand how, you know, you take a bunch of individuals and you put them together in a family or in a group or in a firm or in a market or in a society, and somehow they create order that is sort of different from the individuals themselves. You sort of, you know, it's this kind of emergence that takes place when lots of people interact, and you produce things like institutions, like social norms, like culture, and these are, you know, very much defining of the social world, but they're phenomena that only exist at the collective level. And sociology is all about how do you get from the micro level of individuals to the macro level of society. And it's thought that the key to understanding this is the networks that link people. And so this has you know, been a preoccupation of mine for pretty much my entire research career. And I started off, the way how I got into it was through this sort of puzzle that, you know, everyone now has heard of, called 6 degrees of separation, or what in the sociological literature is called the small world problem. And, you know, many people have heard of these famous experiments that Stanley Milgram did back in the 1960s, where he tried to get a number of people to deliver, people in mostly in Omaha, Nebraska, to deliver packets to a target in Boston, Massachusetts, by sending it to a friend of theirs. And then that person sent it to a friend of theirs, and that person sent it to a friend of theirs, and so on. And what Milgram found was this remarkable result that the length of the chains from Omaha to Boston was only about 6 steps long. And that's where this sort of famous phrase, 6 degrees of separation, came from. This is a story that, you know, many people probably think is an urban myth. Some people still think it's an urban myth. I certainly thought that when I heard about it in the mid-1990s, and I started wondering about how you would prove it. And so, you know, back then, I began a whole series of mathematical investigations trying to understand how it could be true that all of us can live in these little densely connected local environments where, you know, many of our friends are also friends with each other, where you know, where sort of our groups are characterized by, you know, a high degree of homogeneity. Your friends tend to be very much like you in terms of, you know, race and ethnicity and education and income level. And yet, in spite of all this local clustering in the world, it's still possible, or at least it's thought to be possible, for everyone to be connected in just a few steps. And so, you know, this is, you know, that was how I got into this idea of thinking about networks. But once you start to think about this problem in great detail, you start to realize that it's connected to lots of other interesting problems in sociology and in social networks. You know, in particular, if it's true that everyone is connected in just a few steps, you know, what are the implications of that for the way we influence each other, for the way that ideas spread throughout society, for the, you know, for why some things become popular and other things don't? And so, you know, my interest over the years has sort of broadened into these more general questions of sociology. And from there, it's sort of a natural step to this study of influentials and the kinds of outcomes that we observe in marketing.
Right. Now, you were mentioning sort of the, you know, the formation of groups. And there's another theory around the law of 150, which was in Malcolm Gladwell's Tipping Point book, that it was sort of the optimal size for a working group. Anything beyond that sort of became, you know, unwieldy, so to speak.
Yeah.
Do you think that theory is dead now in relationship to new social networks and social networking in general?
No, I don't think it's dead. I think that it needs to be clarified a little bit. I mean, I'm not sure how much empirical evidence there is that 150 is a magic number, but I think it's reasonable to guess that, you know, above a certain size of group, it's very difficult for everyone to know everyone else. And so the Romans thought the magic number was 100. That's why we have the century, and the you know, the century was the sort of lowest level element of the Roman army, precisely because they thought if it got any bigger than that, then the men wouldn't have a sense of cohesion because it would be impossible for everyone to know everyone else well. So I think that, you know, it's certainly possible if you look at sites like Facebook or MySpace or whatever to now see people who have thousands of what they call friends. But I think it's been true for a long time that people have had many more than 100 or 150 friends in their friendship circles. It's just been much more difficult to keep track of them, and so the numbers or the disparity hasn't been quite so obvious as it is now today. And I would say the same thing about, you know, social networks before Facebook and social networks now, which is that as you get more and more people in your friendship circle, the quality of those connections invariably has to decline, or at least the average quality has to decline. And so I suspect that if you, you know, were to examine somebody's Facebook profile and then ask them very carefully about each person on it, you would quickly discover that a relatively small number of these hundreds and hundreds of friends were actually real friends, people who they talk to frequently, people who they do things with, people in whom they invest time and energy and about whom they know sort of, you know, important information. And then the rest of them are just passing acquaintances. And so I think how to tie this back to the law of 150 or 100 or whatever number it actually is that, you know, that's about the number of substantive relationships that you can maintain. So it's possible to maintain many more relationships that are superficial, but they're just that, they're superficial. So the real way to think of this, or the fundamental calculus, is that, you know, there are only so many hours in a day, that we only have so much time and energy and emotional resources to devote to maintaining friendships. And that amount is pretty fixed, right? It you know, it doesn't vary too much from person to person. It doesn't vary much over time. You know, the days haven't gotten any longer or shorter since the Roman times, and our brains haven't gotten any bigger or slower. We're very much the same as we were back then, and we care about the same kinds of things. So the question is, how do we choose to distribute that budget of time and energy? You know, and back in the day, you know, when you lived in a small village and there was only 100 people there, well, you could distribute it, you know, reasonably uniformly. Now we have technology that enables us to interact with thousands of other people, and we have more choices on how to allocate that. And some people will probably choose to do it the old-fashioned way and have a relatively small number of people with whom they share very deep, you know, intense, substantive relationships. And other people will choose to have a very large number of friends and not be very close to any of them. And most of us will fall somewhere in between. So I don't think there's anything inconsistent about the law of 150 and the observation that many people on Facebook have hundreds of friends. I think it's just that the appearance that you get from Facebook is largely misleading. And we don't, you know, what Facebook doesn't tell you is how much each of these relationships means to the people involved. And I think that if it did tell you that, it would all make a lot more sense.
Right. So, I mean, that goes along with a theory I have about how some of these viral marketing techniques, just how repeatable are they? Because, you know, you see people launching on Facebook and, you know, launching a campaign, and sometimes they get a stellar result. I mean, the numbers are outstanding, and sometimes,
yep,
let's say, not. And does,
yep,
that factor into what you were just mentioning?
Well, I think that, you know, empirically, it's certainly the case that there is a huge disparity in success. On, if you look at applications on Facebook, there's about 15,000 of them now. A few of them have, you know, upwards of 10 million people, which is a significant fraction of the entire Facebook population. Most of them have very few people, maybe, you know, only tens of people adopting them, or maybe hundreds. And so, you know, if you were to look at the distribution of how many people have each application, you would see that it's very, very skewed, very lopsided, exactly the same kind of distribution that you see in all kinds of cultural markets, like markets for music or movies or books, where you have a few bestsellers that occupy a big chunk of the market, and then you have a very long tail of lower or poor selling books or movies or whatever. So, you know, that much is, you know, pretty standard. You know, what to do about it? Well, I think it's I think that unfortunately, what it tells you is that getting something to succeed in a viral way is an extremely, you know, unreliable proposition. That, you know, you can certainly lower your chances by building a lousy application or something that's extremely hard to use or breaks all the time or, you know, is sort of just repellent or uninteresting to people. But assuming that you do a good job of making something that's, you know, interesting and nice and has good, you know, attributes, you're still only, I don't know if you're halfway there even. So much of what happens from that point on is a function of the dynamics of the network itself. And as, you know, I've been discussing, it's very hard to predict what is going to happen. And there's not sort of some magic button that you can press where if you just get the right people to adopt this application, it will spread globally. There's no sort of magic formula for how to, you know, create something that's going to just automatically go viral. It really, you know, in any one instance, it really is a bit of a lottery. And, you know, the outcome could be, you know, for the very same application or for two indistinguishable applications under indistinguishable initial conditions could be, you know, all or nothing. And that certainly is something that we see in these simulations, and I'm very sure that it's something that we're seeing on Facebook.
Yeah, definitely. So in manufacturing, you know, people are very quantitative. You know, they benchmark things and where they're doing well, where they're doing not, maybe applying Six Sigma, et cetera, et cetera. Does marketing need to adopt more of a quantitative measure in your mind?
Yeah, I think that is that's true, and I think that it's starting to happen. I think that one of the, you know, there's been a couple of difficulties with marketing following the model of the highly quantitative model and highly benchmarked model of manufacturing. One is that much of the data that you would like to have is extremely hard to collect. So looking at, you know, social networks are notoriously difficult to study and have been for many years. It's very hard to know who is influencing whom with respect to what. It's very hard to keep track of diffusion patterns. And so I think that, you know, part of the reason why marketing has not been as quantitative as other fields is that the kind of data that you would like is very hard to get. I think that's starting to change now, at least online, where in principle you can record lots of things. Something like Facebook, you can, you know, actually see in real time how things are spreading. And so potentially there's all kinds of stuff that we might be able to measure that would be extremely informative. So I think that that is going to change. But I think that the other thing that's a problem is that because marketing deals with people and we have great intuition for why people do what they do, we have a tendency to over-rely on that intuition. And so, you know, in manufacturing, you know, you don't necessarily have great intuition for why there's a certain defect rate. And so the only way you can get to the bottom of it is to measure things very carefully and to, you know, to benchmark your systems against other systems and try to proceed as scientifically as possible. When it comes to marketing a product, you probably look at it and you think you know who's going to like it. And so you create some profile of a representative consumer. You know, you say, well, it's going to be women aged 18 to 36 living in some urban environment, and here's the shops that they go to, and here's the magazines that they read, and, you know, and I'm going to custom tailor a whole marketing campaign around selling this product to that person. And it's very persuasive to us that we can do that. But, of course, that person doesn't really exist, and, you know, the world is a complicated network of different people interacting with each other and interacting with the media. And so when we put this marketing campaign out there, it doesn't work the way we anticipated. And so I think that what, you know, in order to, it's not just a matter of marketers having access to better data. I think that's starting to happen. It's also a matter of marketers sort of understanding that their understanding of the world isn't as good as they think it is, and isn't, you know, that their intuition is not necessarily as reliable as it seems it's going to be. And so therefore you have to do things like controlled experiments where you say, look, I believe that there is this group of consumers who are super influential, and if they like my product, they will get everyone else to like it. And I'm totally convinced of that. But I don't trust myself, right? I don't trust my own intuition. And so I'm going to, you know, in one market, I'm going to take that group of people. I'm going to identify them however I think I need to identify them. And I'm going to invite them to parties or give them free samples or whatever I think is going to work. And then in some other market, I'm going to do something else. I'm either going to not do anything at all, or I'm going to, you know, give it to random people, or I'm going to have a mass marketing campaign instead of word of mouth, and I'm going to have control groups, and I'm going to measure things equally in both markets, and I'm only going to think that I know what I'm doing if I see a significant difference. You know, this is something that's totally standard in medical research, where every time you try a new treatment, you have to have a control group. But for some reason in marketing, that just sort of comes across as a waste of money, because why would you waste money not doing the thing that you know works? But the point is, you don't know that it works. And so I think that, you know, it's very important that we're starting to get these new technologies that help us to measure things, but we also need to have a different worldview in order to know what it is that we need to be measuring.
All right, so if there was one wish that you would have for marketing, or advice that you would have for marketers, you know, what should they be doing when it comes to viral or buzz marketing going forward?
Well, I think the first step on the road, and it's probably a long road, is to acknowledge that as tempting as it is to use one's intuition, it's not very reliable. And so, you know, rather than having marketing strategies that assume you can predict the outcome, that assume that you can tailor initial conditions in such a way that some desired outcome is going to happen down the track, you instead need to have strategies that assume precisely the opposite, that you don't know what is going to happen, that you cannot predict the outcome, that you can't somehow set things up in such a way that the outcome you want, which is everybody adopting your product, is going to follow in some kind of deterministic fashion from the seeds that you set in place. You know, so, you know, it's like when you're playing a game of pool. You know, it's one thing to be able to knock a single ball into the hole. It's quite another thing to sink every ball at the break. And marketing is really like trying to sink every ball at the break. You have one shot, you fire it into the crowd, and they all scatter in their different directions, and you want them all to go in the holes, but that's an extremely difficult thing to engineer at the outset. So forget about it. You can't predict it. So what you need to do is instead have robust strategies that don't rely on prediction. So you throw out, you know, you try many times, you try different variations. You get very good at measuring things. You know, one thing that we can do much better these days is measure stuff. So, you know, you want strategies that you can adjust rapidly on the fly. You want to be able to allocate your marketing spend very flexibly and very rapidly as you realize that the thing you were trying to do or the thing that you intuitively thought was going to work isn't working, but maybe something else is working instead. So these are, I mean, I don't have sort of any kind of panacea or simple solution. I mean, that would sort of be a little bit self-contradictory. But I think that once you sort of get it in your head that, you know, you can't predict what you would like to be able to predict, you're forced to then sort of confront this world and say, okay, you know, how do I respond differently? How do I do things that don't rely on me, on my predictions being correct? And I think that once we start to sort of walk down that path, we become much more empirical, we become, you know, much more open to experimentation, and, you know, we become much more scientific about, you know, trying to sort of guide things in directions that are, you know, to our liking.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Duncan. I really appreciate it. And for our listeners, now it's your turn. Please let us know what you're thinking about any of the data above, especially around the new influentials and how you might be going about viral marketing in your company. We'd be glad to keep this conversation going with you online. We'll be back again next week with another ProfCast. So thank you for listening.